Conference record has joined the conference.
消费。
Hello, this is Ken Ross from the Michigan Credit Union League. We're almost ready to start. We'll start in about 1 minute for all those on the line right now.
Hi, Ken. This is Robin Hogue.
Hi, Robin. John Koloff, are you on the call?
Yes, Ken. Denise Schultheis and I are both on the phone.
Hi, John. Hi, Denise.
Hi.
Chuck Holtzman, are you on the call?
I am, Ken.
Hi, Chuck. Hi, Denise. Hi, John. This is Robin.
Sure.
Hello?
I'm sorry. This is Joe Maloof of OAM.
All right. So we'll get started now since all the speakers are on the call, and hopefully we have good credit union turnout. This call will be recorded, so it will be available for future listening. I just want to give a brief introduction, then I'll turn it over to John. First, by way of tips, if anybody is going to be speaking, I'd ask if you'd please identify yourself at the beginning, whether you're asking a question or speaking, so people know exactly who's talking. Please do not put this call on hold. If you need to be away, feel free to disconnect and then come back on, because we don't want to have anyone's music intruding on the call. And I'd ask everyone to please, if you are going to be speaking, do so into your receiver and not be on the speakerphone, because sometimes that can garble the connection. I want to thank everybody for participating in this call today, which is designed to provide an opportunity for dialogue on the recent guidance issued by the Department of Insurance and Financial Services. I'm also pleased to have John Koloff and Denise Schultheis on the call with us today. And I'd like to thank both John, Denise, and also Leanne O'Brien, who worked along with the league, and Chuck Holtzman and Robin Hogue for the last several months, along with a number of individual credit unions who provided input as this guidance was being developed. We really appreciate the opportunity to provide feedback to John and his team as they looked at this issue in a very thoughtful way over an extended period of time. The goals of the call today is to provide John and Denise with an opportunity to discuss the guidance. Specifically, they'll be providing credit union participants today with background and the context in which the guidance was issued, commentary on the difference of approach used here in Michigan versus elsewhere, providing an overview of the guidance as well as a look at exam focus and next steps. After John provides his presentation, there'll be an opportunity for any additional comments by Chuck Holtzman or Robin Hogue on the legal or regulatory accounting front. And then we'll open up the call to questions by any credit union who'd like to pose a question to any of the participants. So with that, I'll turn it over to John Koloff and Denise Schultheis.
Hi, Ken.
John?
I just want to, again, thank the league for their input on this project. Obviously, this is a significant issue to our Michigan credit unions, and we appreciated having the history feedback that we got from the different working groups that put together for this. So to give you some kind of context of why DIFS decided to put out this new bulletin that supersedes the former bulletin deferred compensation arrangements, here a little over a year, maybe a year and a half ago, we started noticing a twist in the types of deferred compensation arrangements products that were being pushed by some of the insurance companies. We had had some issues in the background that we wanted to improve our former bulletin on some of the due diligence aspects that we had learned over the years, but it was really pushed to a greater importance to us when we started seeing these products. And these products were being evident across the state lines. This is obviously a big issue for NASCUS and NCUA as well. As part of that, NCUA has formed a task force on this, which Denise Schultheis is involved in, and NASCUS is participating in those types of things as well. Other states, in particular the states surrounding Michigan in our region, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, had seen this product and were interested in working to put out some kind of guidelines to their examiners on how to review these twists in the deferred compensation arrangement. The deferred compensation arrangement twist I'm talking about are collateralized split dollar obligations, which, if you're familiar with the way a normal BOLI or bank-owned life insurance product would work, the credit union itself would purchase an investment vehicle under the authority found under 4012SS of the Michigan Credit Union Act, and using that authority to buy what would normally be in-principal investments. They can do that under the Michigan Credit Union Act only to the extent that it's covering obligations related to deferred compensation arrangements. And this bulletin kind of defined that and pushed that out so that not only did it cover what you would normally think of deferred compensation arrangements, but under the directive of the commissioner at that time, it would also cover any obligations for employment that related to any future benefits. So that would include health insurance, et cetera. So fast forward, we now see these collateral split dollar obligations where instead of being an insurance company owned, or is the insurance provision is owned by the credit union, in the collateralized split dollar world, typically what you see is the borrower or the person receiving the economic benefit, the executive in this case, would take out a loan to the credit union, a reoccurring payments on an insurance policy. The policy would be written in the name of the executive for tax purposes, and the loan the credit union made to the executive would be collateralized or secured by the insurance policy. Having seen these show up in Michigan, Denise started going out and looking at these plans so that we could get comfortable with them and understand the impact that they have and what changes might need to be done in our review of them relative to the new structure. We spent about a year looking at these across the state and many different plans, some institutions who did them very well, some institutions who did them very poorly, I have to be honest. And we come up with these guidelines related to that. In short, what we're doing with the bulletin is, under the new provisions, we're stating that the collateralized split dollar obligation, since it's a loan product and it's created in that fashion, the transaction is created that way for tax purposes, that collateralized split dollar obligation would be treated as a loan just like we would treat any other collateralized loan, particularly one that's collateral dependent, if that's the case. So the 4012SS, the authority to purchase impermissible investments, is not used for that specific type of product. The BOLI, however, since it's owned by the credit union, would be an investment made by the credit union, and 4012SS would apply. Further, what we've done throughout the bulletin is try to improve the guidance out there for the deferred compensation arrangements in particular, but also specific to collateralized split dollars, because if you're securing these issues with loans, obviously need to understand how to secure an insurance policy, perfect that lien, et cetera. We also had concerns about due diligence by boards for them understanding the long-term impact of these cash flows. We found evidence that in many of these cases, or didn't necessarily understand that the long-term nature of the payment and how it was going to affect either the income stream of the institution or its balance sheet, or that they failed to recognize unfunded commitments. So we talk about the reporting of these types of products on the call report. We talk about recognition of income for these, particularly those at the front end that would have cash flow, or I'm sorry, they would have liquidation value shortfalls from the principal balance of the loan because they're early on in the stage. Having said that, I want to kind of break and make sure everybody understands the difference between the products. Is there any questions related to the products?
Might I say everybody to mute their phones out there, John? Thanks.
Sure, if there's anybody else, I mean, I can hear somebody buzzing in, so if you, everybody could put their phone on mute unless they do have a question, that'd be great. Having said that, I'll have Denise Schultheis, who is really our resident expert on this, go through just a short and sweet summary of the different sections of the bulletin and what they're meant to entail.
Hi. The bulletin itself that was, well, the bulletin that was previously outstanding, bulletin 2008-09, all of the provisions of the pre-existing bulletin are still present within this one. What we've simply done is expand greatly any of the areas that we need to be aware of, consider before investing in what would otherwise be an impactful investment or one of these assignment split dollars. A lot of the risks are the same. So in the bulletin, we give a little bit of background about the authorities, but under the requirements section, the first and one of the largest sections is the basic safety and soundness considerations defined for boards and management. The different questions you should be asking when looking at what would otherwise be an impermissible investment, be it the interest rate risk, which might apply, be it the liquidity risk. A lot of these investments that we're seeing are large in nature, quite often very material to the balance sheet, and quite often present a very large concentration of assets in non-liquid form. So much of the due diligence is really important up front to understand this, committing these large and quite often illiquid amounts investment products. It talks a little bit about compliance risk and the importance of having independent review, be it legal, be it CPA, be it if you're purchasing an insurance product, rather than relying on the salesperson who's selling you the product to make sure that you're getting some independent advice, to make sure that you understand what you're actually purchasing and so forth. Talks a little bit about credit risk and transaction risk, the importance of having some independent oversight of the product, and regular reporting to the board so the board can continually monitor it. The second section of the bulletin is the purpose and investment relationship section. It basically provides boards and management a little bit of insight on what we're looking at when we're determining from a safety and soundness perspective what an appropriate investment is relative to the deferred compensation obligation that it's intended to offset. So it talks a little bit about that. It also talks about materiality thresholds, which are the same as in the previous bulletin. Just a brief summary, 15% of net worth is what, for examination purposes, we will consider to be a material investment. Understand that for collateral assignment split dollar being a loan product, the loan aggregate limitation within the Act is going to apply to that being a loan product. There is another section on accounting reporting, as John mentioned, talking about the appropriate accounting, what's being looked at there, the appropriate reporting pursuant to all report purposes. And there is roughly a page that is also dedicated to the collateral assignment split dollar. Now, understand this section covers all investments, which would be otherwise impermissible, but are permissible because they are to fund deferred compensation products. So all of the same due diligence and risk considerations are going to apply to the collateral assignment split dollar, but we also have a page that is specific to that because we're seeing some unique risk characteristics in there and some unique aspects of that that we have seen cause confusion in various institutions. So we've provided a little bit of insight and guidance as to certain risks to be looked at specific to those and how we are going to evaluate them from an examination standpoint. And that is the basic essence of this bulletin that is coming out, or that is out. Does anybody have any questions about the bulletin? Okay. John, do you want to take it?
That's really all the commentary I have on the issue, Ken, unless there's specific questions.
Yeah, John, could you or Denise provide the attendees with some general comments on expected exam focus? How are you going to be treating this? What will you be looking for? Will this be anything special or just as part of the routine exam cycle? Any insights there?
Sure. It's going to be just part of the regular exam cycle. I don't know how many of you on the phone remember, but under the old act back prior to 2003, any deferred compensation plan had to be pre-approved by back then FIB. Under the new act, we worked pretty hard, the industry and the regulator, to make that something that would not be a pre-approval, that the institutions could go ahead and do their own due diligence and work on those. So we won't be looking at those. Obviously, if there's an institution that would like us to look at some of those in the front end, we will try to do that for them, give them some feedback. But the expectation is that we'll look at these as part of the regular exams process. Obviously, we're going to scope our reviews around the materiality of the transaction relative to the balance sheet. Just, you know, we are going to maintain our risk-based exam process. And the impact, potential impact that it has to the institution being typically the effect that we're looking at here on these plans is going to be an effect to the earning stream of the institution and potential balance sheet recognition because of the difference in the collateral shortfall, because like I said, on the front end of these plans, you know, any insurance policy you buy on the front end is going to have a pretty significant discount or cash surrender value that you would have to pay to get out of it. So obviously there's some liquidity there.
All right, and John, could you talk a little bit more about that particular aspect, because that's a key one I know for a lot of credit unions as they look at these plans, whether they have one now or if they potentially have one in the future, and that is the early year implications from a balance sheet perspective. Could you talk about how you're viewing that and what a credit union would need to do in those early years?
Sure, and I'll try to I'm going to talk about both types of plans because I think it's important to recognize the differences in them while also recognizing the similarities of how we're going to treat them. If a BOLI on the front end, anytime you buy an insurance policy that's requiring annual payments, or actually anytime you buy an insurance policy on the front end, the cash surrender value of that insurance policy is going to be significantly less than the book value or the amount of money that you put into it. On the BOLI side of things, if that was a BOLI, that would be recorded as basically an adjustment on the balance sheet based on, just like you would do an AFS adjustment, in essence. So the book value that you might have put in is, say, $1 million, but on the first year, it's the insurance policy cash surrender value is probably going to only be $750,000, let's say, as an example. So that $250,000 would be reported on the call report as an adjustment out there so that we would know that there's that possible implication to regulatory capital. Obviously, our job as regulators is to understand, you know, not just the net worth that's reported for GAAP and accounting purposes, but the net worth that's available for losses that the institution experiences. And that $250,000 that I just gave you the example of obviously wouldn't be there if something were to happen in the next 12 months. If you look at that same policy, but you put it in the collateralized split dollar world, the institution would pay in that $1 million. And again, that life insurance policy is a cash surrender value would only be $750,000. But what we'd be looking at now is a loan on the books for the institution to the executive that is doing this, probably with some recognition of income, because typically these are done at a cost of funds amount for the institution, a calculated cost of funds amount. So the interest on the note to the executive would be whatever that cost of funds amount is. What we're saying on in the bulletin is that we're going to treat that as any other collateral dependent loan. And the way we treat collateral dependent loans as regulators is we would discount the loan amount down to the cash surrender value of the collateral. So in the case that we're talking about, you'd have a $1 million book value loan, a $750,000 cash surrender value, which we would write that down to. We would expect that your allowance recognize that $250,000 shortfall, as well as we wouldn't allow the recognition of the income on the cost of funds calculation until such point as the cash surrender value started to exceed the book value of the loan. So in the first few years, you probably wouldn't be recognizing any of the income. We would treat it just like any other non-accrual loan, because obviously these loans and the collateralized split dollars wouldn't require monthly payments or anything like that.
All right, John, before we go to any comments by Chuck Holtzman or Robin Hogue, do you have any suggested next steps that the division, I mean, the office is suggesting credit unions take after the issuance of this guidance?
I think what we have discovered from what we're looking at and what we're hoping to obtain with this, the bulletin is, one, that my staff understand how to review these issues, but I think more importantly, we've had a couple of examples, pretty extreme examples of institutions that have developed these programs internally. And while it wasn't a problem necessarily with the product type of the investment, because of the dollars involved, because of the legal risks involved, they really didn't do their due diligence. And I'm hopeful that institutions, particularly the boards, are very meet their fiduciary duty when they're looking at types of plans. I don't want to cloud the picture, because I will say that some institutions have these already out there, and they've done a great job of documenting that the board understood what they were getting into. I've seen some institutions that even have a BOLI aspect to a deferred compensation program as well as a collateralized split dollar, and have done a good job with it. But unfortunately, I have seen a couple of institutions, one so significant that they have several attorneys working on the issue and have met with us regarding whether or not we would be taking action against the institution because of the impact of the deferred compensation arrangement to their balance sheet and the potential for being insolvent.
All right, so now let's have an opportunity for Chuck Holtzman and Robin Hogue. First, you, Chuck, do you have any additional brief comments that you'd like to make based on what you've heard from John?
I'd just like to make a couple of comments at this time. Thanks, Ken. When we were working with John and his team in drafting the bulletin, one of the goals we were trying to achieve was to not significantly impact any of the plans that were already out there that had been implemented by credit unions. We had some conversations in the past about potentially putting some grandfathering language into the bulletin, but for those of you who have read the bulletin, you'll see there is no such language. And I think one of the reasons why there isn't that type of language in the document is because I think John and his team did a pretty good job of drafting this bulletin in the end, and drafting it to allow sufficient flexibility to take into the unique and individual nature of these plans that are going to exist from credit union to credit union to credit union. So I think that any credit union that's listening in on this call that has a deferred compensation plan on the books, whether it be a collateral assignment split dollar or any other type of plan, the first thing you have to know is you don't need to panic. I don't think that there's anything in this bulletin that is going to significantly change the nature of the plans, the benefits that have been provided to the executive, or any of the rights or liabilities of the parties. One of the things, though, that credit unions may have to do is there may need to be certain plan amendments to specific plans depending upon how the credit union may be accounting for the investments, how the credit union may be booking them, and things of that nature. So I think that now may be a good time for all credit unions that either have these plans or are considering these plans to have somebody take a second look to make sure that we've got compliance with some of the minimum requirements that the bulletin sets forth. For example, in paragraph 2F, the bulletin sets forth certain minimum requirements that the plan documents need to have. It doesn't really tell you what those plan provisions need to be, but one of the things that it requires is that it clearly state what the benefits are. So everybody should be looking at their plan to make sure that what you believe this plan is going to provide is clearly stated within the plan. One area that we think credit unions really need to pay close attention to, and those would be in situations especially where a credit union executive has an employment agreement, and especially where that employment agreement may have been drafted by somebody other than the person who drafted the deferred compensation plan. You need to make certain that the language between the two documents is consistent with one another, because if it's not consistent, you're likely going to create a field day for lawyers somewhere down the road. And I can't speak for all the lawyers, but for some of us, we've got plenty to do. We don't need to generate lots more work later on down the road because things may have been ambiguous. So especially in those areas where the plans talk about forfeiture and the circumstances under which an executive could forfeit the deferred compensation plan, we need to make certain that those particular provisions are consistent with whatever similar provisions may exist within the employment agreement. So from what we've seen in terms of the bulletin and what we've seen over the years in the industry, I don't think that there's anything that this bulletin is going to require that can't be addressed through some simple amendments to any plans that may be out there.
Thanks, Chuck. And now I'll turn over to Robin Hogue for a few comments.
Thanks, Ken. This is Robin Hogue. Just a couple of points I wanted to just clarify, especially relating to looking backwards, and Chuck had commented on the non-existence of a grandfather clause in the bulletin, and appropriately so based on the objectives that John and Denise were trying to achieve for safety and soundness. But I was wondering if John can maybe comment for the audience, is all of the points that relate to due diligence that may or may not have been done by boards previously and the amount of oversight, I assume that there's a significant expectation that all the boards are going to and the executives are going to need to go back and get all their plans, both, as Chuck indicated, integrated between the employment agreement and deferred comp, and updated and documented due diligence. John, can you or Denise comment on that for the audience?
Yes. I mean, I guess the way I would say it is, if I would hope that due diligence that we've written on would have already been covered in the initial review, but if not, then obviously we would want that. The big issues would be the one Chuck appropriately pointed out, that the deferred compensation arrangement and its clauses match the normal employment agreement that they have. The other issues that we're would be looking at would not be that would be kind of looking back would be the documentation to support the amount that's invested, et cetera. I think one of the things that we've seen many boards didn't realize is the amount of unfunded commitment that they were going to have out there. And a lot of institutions, I shouldn't say a lot, several institutions we looked at didn't report those unfunded commitments. Obviously, those types of things would have to be reviewed formally by the board and to ensure that they've covered the documentation that we're required or that we're going to be looking for as part of the bulletin.
Thanks, John. One of the points I think that you brought up, which is very, very important, I think, that the Cardian audience pay attention to is not only the call report of the outstanding balances, but the unfunded commitments is clearly in the bulletin. So if in your example there was a funding that there was $300,000 a year in the second year, there's $600,000 in a loan outstanding if it's a collateral assigned split dollar program, but there's a remaining unfunded commitment of $300,000 for 8 more years. So that $2.4 million is going to need to go on their call report, and I think from a compliance, that's really important. And also to take a look at their both concentration risk, and because it's in most cases, depending on whether or not the boards and the executives have documented the positive intent and ability to repay, if an executive were to leave voluntarily or involuntarily before the cash surrender value or the value of the investment product catches up to the outstanding loan, one of the couple situations we've run into is it's extremely important, if it wasn't documented originally, that each credit union figure out whether or not there is a true intent and ability to repay by the borrower, which in many cases is a CEO or some other senior executive, if there is a voluntary or involuntary termination prior to the cash surrender value catching up to the outstanding loan balances. And that typically can run 5 to 10 years. So credit unions need to pay very, very close attention. And if they have to do some evaluation and underwriting for those loans that are outstanding, otherwise, if they don't do that underwriting, they're going to have to set up some type of allowance for loan loss. As you indicated earlier, John, in your scenario, the $1 million versus $750,000 cash surrender value, that's going to require an allowance of $250,000 if there's not an extremely well-documented, proven, updated, and monitored annually by the credit officers and or a third party or the board to make sure that that differential doesn't end up being in a truly unsecured situation. Any other comments you might share on that, John?
No, I agree totally with what you're saying, and particularly with the collateralized split dollar obligations. Because we are defining those as loans, that's what the transaction is set up to be, and that's what we're trying to make very clear in our bulletin, that those are loans. That the other issue they're going to have to look back on is the 25% aggregate limit that we have to any investment or any obligor, that concentration risk limitation that's found in the Act.
Excellent.
But I agree. If we have, as I said before, if we have a loan without any proven capacity to repay, in other words, a loan that is the ability to repay is completely directed by the collateral value, the way we as regulators treat that in any circumstance, whether it's a commercial loan, a consumer loan, a residential loan, would be liquidation value of the collateral would be the high, the maximum book value you would get. So, the book value or the cash surrender value of the insurance policy in this case. The difference would be a classification on our side or an allowance methodology on the institution side, again, assuming there isn't a proven capacity to repay based on the underwriting of the institution.
Understood. Those are good comments, John. Thank you. Just another thought along that same line. If you've got an executive with a collateral signed split dollar program, and they're reporting on the call report the actual loan and the unfunded commitment under the program, does the unfunded commitment calculate into the 25% limit, John, for the loan capacity? I think that's in 423.
Yes. Unfunded commitments do count as part of, because they do have an obligation to fund that.
Understood. Good point. So if there's $600,000 in a loan outstanding and there's another $2.4 million commitment, they really need to look at the 25% limitation for the whole dollar value of the future commitment.
In your example, correct.
Okay. Now, one of the item that comes to mind is if each year when they're, if this is a collateral assigned split dollar or a more traditional BOLI plan where the Cardian ends the life insurance product, there's going to be a difference on each annual premium payment. There's going to continue to be a difference in the outstanding cash surrender value versus the actual loan amount or the invested dollar value. So would it not require that as a Cardian executive with an intent to repay, which has recourse in the note, and in a situation that they have personal assets, is the Bureau going to expect them to pledge those assets directly, or can it be a blanket personal pledge? Like, I'm thinking about if they have the intent to repay is one thing. How do they prove the capacity to ensure the Bureau is comfortable that they've got adequate collateralization over the cash surrender value so that they don't have to put together a allowance for loan loss reserve? Any thoughts by you and Denise on this?
Well, only that those are so individualistic. Obviously, it's going to be highly dependent on documentation in the file.
You know, so we'll the suggestion is document, and don't leave it open to interpretation. Make sure there's more than enough collateral to cover the difference.
Collateral or capacity to repay. I mean, we're not necessarily looking for additional collateral, although that's one way to address the issue. If you've got a loan that's underwater for cash surrender value or the liquidation value, then that's one way to address it. Or if it's capacity to repay, that you've documented there's a capacity to repay this other than, you know, just the proceeds of the death benefit.
Understood. Those are good points, John. Thank you. Ken, those are some of the most significant comments that I had based on prior input from the other participants.
Appreciate that, Robin. All right, so now we're going to throw it open for questions from any other attendees on the call. If you'd identify yourself and ask your question in a clear voice, please.
This is Tony Carnarvon, Co-op Services. I have a question if we needed to fund the allowance account. In terms of how would that impact the executive, are there any other ramifications for having to fund the allowance account because I personally have a loan that's underwater? Are there tax implications? What type of implications come to the executive in that case?
If it's okay, this is Robin Hogue, I'll field that. I don't see any tax implications because you've gotten no additional benefit at that point in time. The credit union still has a positive intent to receive all its assets, so it hasn't forgiven the debt. So I don't see any reason why there would be any tax implications. Even though it would be recorded as a substandard asset and have an allowance against it, they haven't legally forgiven the debt, and there's no in this scenario, Tony, there was no intent to forgive it. It's really an operation at this point of regulation and the related accounting that goes with that that observation and characterization of the regulation.
Okay, yeah. Thanks.
And just to add on to that, the only implication I could see would be in the case of default separation if, there was a forgiveness given at the end.
Understood. I do have another question. John, you had mentioned that if the value of the cash surrender value is less than the actual loan note, that you wouldn't be able to recognize any type of income from that. How does that differ from a mortgage loan where the value is not equal to the note?
Well, the short answer to that is that on the mortgage note, you have capacity to repay proven, hopefully.
Okay.
So you've done an analysis that the borrower can afford the debt service capacity repayment, whatever that is, you know, debt to income. And most of these plans, we will accept that. If you're making a loan, the executive has the capacity to repay the loan. However, the way most of these loans are written out, there is no payment structure set up, and it's not likely that you could actually prove repayment capacity from the income of the borrower, in this case, the executive. They're not set up that way, typically.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
But if that is there, and that's what Robin and I were talking about earlier, if on the front end of these, we're going to look at them as we would any other loan, if on the front end there's a capacity to repay proven, or as Robin had mentioned, one of the options would be additional collateral presented, from the executive to cover that deficiency on the front end, because the way these plans work, you're going to have a deficiency on the cash surrender value on the front end the first few years until the underlying investment, in this case the insurance policy, has had a chance to start making money. And then at that point, you will exceed the book value of the cash surrender value. And at that point, we would then recognize the income stream from this type of product. Does that make sense, Tony?
Yes and no. So what I thought I heard you say is if we can demonstrate the ability to pay, we could recognize the interest income. Is that the key there?
Correct.
Okay. Or there's sufficient collateral to cover, a combination of either one.
Ability to repay could be the ability for the borrower to repay just for a normal earnings or income stream aspect, debt service,
okay,
or additional collateral that at liquidation value would cover the entire loan amount.
Okay. And I hate to monopolize, but kind of going on a train of thought, if we're to say, okay, I don't have any collateral, but I do have the ability to repay, what type of term would we be looking at for the ability to repay? Is it looking like another 30-year mortgage or something like that? Because clearly some of these gaps can be quite wide.
Well, and to be honest with you, I'm not sure because I've never seen one. Again, most of these plans, all of them, are structured so that there is no monthly or annual payment by the executive.
No, I meant that to demonstrate the ability to repay, if necessary, for the gap.
Is it the case that because the cash surrender value over the time of the first several years will gradually get larger, that should be a calculable time period? And at the end of that period, your loan value meets the cash surrender value?
That's right.
Your loan value, the book value that we would let you, where we would recognize on the books, would be either the cash surrender value, if that's lower, or the book value of the fund, so how much money is out in the loan product, the book value of the loan. When we're talking about debt service, we would treat it like any other loan. So when you bring in a borrower and you're looking at whether that borrower can pay a $40,000 car, that same debt service capacity would have to be proven for the executive for whatever the amount of the note is. So if the note is written as a single payment note, 10 years from now, then you'd have to prove that they could pay whatever that dollar amount is 10 years from now. It's possible you could structure these with monthly payments. We haven't seen one like that, but if you did structure it with monthly payments, you'd have to show that the executive has the capacity to repay the monthly payments that would cover the cash flow. I'll be honest with you, I can't imagine anybody doing it that way.
John, okay. This is Chuck Holzman, if I could just jump in for a minute. Hey,
sure.
Tony, one of the things that I mentioned earlier that I like about this bulletin is the fact that it does create flexibility for each individual credit union to come up with their own way to address this issue if they either, A, want to try to recognize the earnings off of it while the cash surrender value is still less than the aggregate investment, or they want to book it at the higher amount. So I like the fact that there's not some concrete formula that says if you're going to do this, it has to be done that way. It really, I think, goes back to the GAAP standard that says we have to look at intent and ability on a facts and circumstances method as it relates to each individual plan. So the solution that might work great for co-op services could potentially be a different solution than may work for some other credit union. And I think it's just going to be a function of the executive, the board, their CPA, and their attorney all working together, trying to identify what the ultimate goal is, and then making sure that the plan and the accounting are consistent with that.
Hey, John, this is Steve Eimert at Sharon and Lodgen in Boston. I just want to clarify one thing you said to make sure I understand. We've done a lot of these plans in various states over the years. My understanding is when a credit union goes to underwrite, if you will, the executive's note for the premium loan, the relevant amount wouldn't be the full notional amount of the note. It would be the difference at any given time, which tends to be 1 year's worth of premium or less, between the cash surrender value of the policy as it bills and the total premium loans the credit union has made. So it's not the full amount of the loan, it's the difference between the collateral value and the remainder of the premium loan.
Well, again, I think you're misunderstanding how we as regulators look at loans. We look at the primary source of repayment. The primary source of most loans for repayment is the debt service capacity of the borrower. So in that scenario, we would want to know that the executive could pay off the entire portion of the loan because our intent is not to collect the collateral. The secondary source of repayment in most loan analysis is whatever collateral that you have. In these loans, because there typically is no, there is very few, if any, underwriting of the borrower. So I think your example is not exactly accurate, because in typically of these plans, there is no debt service capacity analysis of the executive. The only source of repayment is intended to be the insurance policy itself.
So I understand that, but to the extent that
since that analysis, these would be collateralized, what we call collateral-dependent loans. Regulators look at collateral-dependent loans at a cash surrender value liquidation amount.
All right. Can I see if there's any more credit union questions?
This is Mike Newman down at Monroe County Community Credit Union. Using the cash surrender value gap, for the lack of a better term, if the executive personal net worth statement does justify the difference, if I understand it right, we do not have to do the allowance. To piggyback that, I'm assuming that that would have to be verified annually, and as part of that review process, what are the site examiners going to be looking for, i.e., personal net worth, you know, the standard stuff. You've got your cash deposit, you got your 401k retirement, the equity in your home, whatever the case may be. Are they going to be looking for, like, a reappraisal, for example, of a home, if that's added into the personal net worth statement? Is that something that's going to have to be done annually?
Yeah, we would expect the same kind of underwriting or due diligence we would expect of any other loan. So I would first, the first thing that you said that I would kind of clarify is that in essence, a statement of net worth that would cover the gap would be sufficient. And I can't say that that would necessarily cover it. You'd have to have something legally as well to make sure that that collateral is available. For the institution, in the case.
Some type of security interest, John?
A security interest, potentially a guarantee. It would be, again, these are highly individualistic, highly individualistic products. So it would be particularly dependent on the loan that they make. So once we get past that, let's say that there is some sort of securitized interest in the other collateral. Then we would look at that and relative to, and like we would look at any other loan. And that's what we're trying to do here, is we're trying to make this very simple to the industry by saying, we're going to treat this like any other loan. The board should treat it like any other loan too. Therefore, regular reviews, as you were implying, regular reviews of the borrower to make sure that that creditworthiness is still there, or if there is some issues, that difference is recognized. Obviously, the dollar amount that we're going to be concerned is the gap, because that would not be available for us as regulators if we had to take our whatever action, you know, we have to take. It's not available in the case of a liquidation or a conservatorship because of the issues. That's what regulatory capital measures, is the amount of capital available for us if we have to take some action.
So we've got another question.
the short story would be, just to clarify on that one, is that you should treat that like you would treat any other commercial loan. It should be underwritten appropriately. If you're going to use the debt service capacity of the executive, you prove that there's that debt service capacity. You've done that analysis that if you have to term this loan out, that at least that gap could be paid for by the executive, et cetera. That you're checking on the collateral securitization, every so often to make sure that you have that. Given it's an insurance product, every few years you would expect an analysis on the actuarial study to make sure that the investment is progressing in the manner that it was presented to the board in the front end, because obviously depending on the economic cycle and what's going on with interest rates, that affects the performance of these types of investments as well.
Thank you.
Yes, who's got another question?
Murphy Ward. My question would be, what if it's not a loan? What if it's an annuity that the credit union invests in with a guarantee of the original principal?
If it's an annuity, then what you're doing is you're buying this. It's a BOLI. Is that correct?
Okay, yes.
So under the BOLI methodology, owned by the credit union, it's obviously not a loan. We treat it as an investment. Under that scenario, you'd have to report the cash surrender value gap on the call report because the call report already covers that shortfall.
Okay.
There's a spot on the call report that would require you to report that deficiency, whatever that balance difference is between your cash surrender value and the book value, if there was one.
Okay, so
there's
if there's a guarantee that the credit union gets their initial deposit back regardless of how it amortizes over the period of time, how would you classify that? Would you still use the actual cash value the same way?
Yes, the end result is the same. Regulatory capital purposes, we would only recognize the cash surrender value if it exceeded the book value. So if the book value is higher than the cash surrender value, we're not going to recognize that as part of your regulatory capital because it's obviously not available for us as regulators. And technically, it's not available for you, for the institution, if there were to be something happening in the next 12 months. The board couldn't call on that, let's say, $250,000 deficiency to support losses because that money's already out.
Okay, got it.
So they're treated the same at the end from an accounting standpoint. The difference being is that BOLIs are already structured into the call report, and currently NCUA instructions don't talk about how to deal with collateralized split dollars. That's another reason for the guidance.
There is another question.
Mark Edwanski, Monroe County Community Credit Union. For the collateral split dollar plans, based on the bulletin, does the amount of the loan on the books, which is basically the premiums paid, are they now reported as loans on the call report?
Yes.
Okay.
And the deficiency would then, we would expect to see that in your allowance on the collateral split value, liquidation value of that. I should say, until it exceeds the book value, and then obviously you would record the book value, and then you would also be able to record any earnings on it, because again, usually these set at an agreed upon cost of funds value interest rate stated on the loan.
Okay, thanks.
Is there another question? John, what are the biggest concerns that you can report that you've seen after having done this look at the CASD and other policies out in the field?
The biggest issue to me is just ensuring that the board understands what they're getting into, because, again, I've had a couple of institutions that came in and have it was very evident after we looked at what they looked at that they didn't have a clue either to the extent or the concentration of the program and how much it was going to affect the institution. Sometimes that's on the legal risk. I think Chuck made a very good point on the separation agreements that were stated in the deferred compensation agreement. One of the institutions I'm talking about, that deferred compensation agreement did not match at all the regular employment agreement. It wasn't looked at by their attorneys. It wasn't understood well by them from a either the unfunded commitments and what those were outstanding, or from an accounting standpoint of just how to account for these things. So I think that's my biggest issue. Obviously, credit unions have the ability to make these either fully investments under 401(2)(SS) or make loans to their executives under this type of plan under just the regular lending authority and limitations there are related to that in the Act. I don't think it's necessarily the investment products that got the institutions in trouble. I think it's just the extended terms of these products and the lack of understanding from some of the boards when they approved them. And to be honest with you, a lack of understanding from some of the executives that worked on them. Another issue would be independence. We've seen it where the executive, was running this program, and the board had no idea, or I should rephrase that. The board didn't document that they understood what was happening, let alone that they were providing oversight for how the plan was being run. And that's what we're really looking for. We want documented due diligence that the board saw what the product was, understood the long-term ramifications, understood how it was going to affect the income stream of the organization, its balance sheet, how it affects the liquidity risk, interest rate risk, et cetera, and all those issues, and then has made a determination on the reasonableness of the plan, et cetera.
All right, John, I want to thank you for taking time from your day-to-day to talk with everybody for the last hour. For any credit union that didn't have an opportunity to ask their question, I invite you to contact MCUL Government Affairs. John, I hope you'll be willing to take further questions from us and to provide clarity as this issue rolls out in the credit union community. And I want to thank everybody again for participating today.
Thank you, Ken. Again, I want to thank the league for not only providing input on the front end with the different participants that have been on some of the calls that we've had and reviewed some of the earlier versions of this product, but also for helping us to answer any questions on this. We are definitely interested in anybody that any institution that have any questions on this. Denise Schulteis is our regional expert here now because she's looked at these all over the state. She's also on NCUA's task force that's going to deal with deferred compensation arrangements on the national level. So obviously we're very interested in understanding how this bulletin and the product impacts our institutions so that we can make sure that whatever comes out of the national level is appropriate without being onerous.
Thank you very much, and thank you, credit unions, for participating.
Thank you, John, for giving us the opportunity.
Thank you, John.
Thanks. Bye.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in two minutes.
Chuck Holzman, are you there?
The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end. The